Welcome to the All About Alts podcast, where we explore the world of alternative investing to help you find financial independence. Join our host, Newview Trust's president, Jason DeBono, as he covers a variety of topics with different guest speakers to discuss tax and alternative investing strategies. It is never too late to start taking control of your financial future, and we are so excited for you to be joining us for this opportunity to hear from some of the best in the business.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the All About Alts podcast. I am your host, Jason DeBono, joined with Lauren Wells from 70 Investments. Miss Lauren, how are you?
I'm good. Like you mentioned earlier, we're just getting through halfway through my day over here on the West Coast.
Yeah, and we're wrapping things up. So if I think Lauren's just after lunch and I'm at the end of my day. So if either of us look sleepy, we've got a good excuse for it. So tell us a little bit, let's talk a little bit about 70 and kind of what that is and what that sort of business looks like. And then we'll talk a little bit about your story and how 70 kind of came into fruition and how you got into the investment world.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here and kind of share my backstory, my experience, and kind of what we're doing today. So 70 is a real estate investment firm that provides the opportunity for passive monthly income through mortgage note investing. I like to say we fix and flip mortgage notes, and specifically notes that are secured by single family homes throughout the US. And we can dive into that whole fix and flip process a little bit later, but essentially at a high level, we are buying mortgage notes, first deeds, at a discount on the secondary market. We are rehabbing the borrower and then getting it from non-performing to performing. And then we are selling it back on the secondary market for a profit. So similar to the fix and flip model, except for with mortgage notes.
I love it. And, we were catching up earlier and, when she said rehab the borrower, I was like, all right, we are going to talk a lot about that because that's a term that I have not heard. We've all seen enough TV shows on fix and flipping real estate, but there's a really cool spin, I think, that 70 and Lauren specifically has put on kind of this private debt world, which I love, near and dear to my heart. I've been doing a lot of private loans over my time as an investor, but never really this approach. So more to come on that. Maybe that saves some suspense for the latter half of the show. Before we get there, let's talk about how you got into this, right? You were at one point sitting in the seat of some education saying, I want to be like future Lauren and be an investor. How'd that spark hit you, resonate? How did you kind of work through that? And let me just add this, because you may not talk about it yourself, but I know some back information. But Lauren's portfolio today is over 100 assets in residential real estate and private notes, which I think for those listening, getting to 3 or 4 or 5 or 7 or 10 assets is hard. Getting into triple digits is very impressive. So Lauren, we're all ears, myself included.
Yeah, thanks so much. Man, it kind of goes back before I was sitting in a listener's seat. I actually graduated from university and I played collegiate sports. I played water polo. And so I decided to volunteer coach at a local high school while I was also working a corporate software sales job, very California, Silicon Valley, like what you see in the movies. Except for they glamorize it a lot more. So I was working, in the off hours as a water polo coach, and I saw all these parents here. And I was like, I kept thinking, these parents are like at all the games, all the practices, what are they doing? Like, how are they here all the time? And I started to kind of pick like people's brains on like what they did and what was their line of work, these parents. And it was always they either invested in real estate or they own their own business. And I wasn't married at the time, but you could call me, I don't know, what was I, like 22 going on 40. And I was like, I know I want kids in the future. So I thought, how can I start working towards this reality now where I can have that flexibility and kind of ownership of my time? And in the interim, it would be used to travel and kind of do all those fun things. And then later on attend, be involved and present, I guess, for my kids. And so I used my sales commission from my corporate software sales job to fund my real estate investments. And I didn't just kind of jump into it right away. I did a lot of listening to webinars, attending every networking event you could possibly think of, messaging people on LinkedIn all like incessantly, and just trying to pick the brains of people who were in areas of interest. And mortgage notes was one of those areas. I stumbled across it at a local real estate investment group, and someone had mentioned, hey, you don't necessarily need to own the home. You can actually become the bank. And as I'd seen many of my colleagues and friends kind of get into that, I need to, because when you think passive income, you think, okay, buy a piece of property, rent it out, cash flow. That's like, I think what everyone's mind defaults to. And I had seen the horror stories around that, especially in California as a landlord. And I was like, I don't really want to do that. I don't want to deal with, why does the fridge always break when you're living there, but not when I'm living there? So I went the mortgage note route. I actually started investing in second position liens. And the reason I did that was because I knew I could get more bang for my buck. I could diversify my portfolio. I didn't need as much upfront capital to invest in a second as I would need a first. So I read all the books, which make it seem like very passive and like a walk in the park. And I honestly just dove in and found a mentor who did seconds. And he taught me how to bid, all the like, you know, minutia behind foreclosure, working with a borrower, what that looked like. And really, he mentored me. And that's where I kind of started. I bought my first set of notes, was about 10. And then I kind of scaled from there up to 50 before I met Chris, my current business partner, and made that transition to first. And then what Chris and I realized running our past funds was that there were a ton of people who were interested, but either had never heard of notes, were not accredited. And so we were doing tons of joint ventures, like one-off deals. And so that's kind of where 7E came to be, was to really provide education and information to allow people to understand not only what is a mortgage note, but also like, how do you evaluate a deal? Like, how do you evaluate a sponsor? What does that look like? I always like to say, because Chris and I are of different generations, I am what I would consider an elder millennial. And I always think of my contemporaries and how they're some of the most brilliant people I know, but have no idea how to invest their money. They're so stuck in their SaaS startup job or their, you know, tech company, and they don't see outside of that. So I'm always speaking to like those people. Like, how do I tell them there's other options? You don't have to like only rely on your W-2 sales job. So that's how I got here.
Well, that latter part is certainly prudent advice. I think so many people, you know, they get caught up in their salary, which is critical. You know, you especially, you know, you're working, you want to get paid and you want to feel like you're rewarded for the effort that you're contributing. But at the same time, you know, that can be a real trap, right? You know, you get a raise, you increase your lifestyle, you get a raise, you increase your lifestyle. And then you get to a point where you go, if I don't make $150,000 a year, you know, I can't even, you know, pay my rent. And then you start thinking, well, good luck making a career change. Good luck finding passive income. So, you know, it sounds like I think the key takeaways that I heard, you know, from you, I mean, number one, congratulations on being inquisitive. You know, it sounds really easy to do, but you know, there's a reason why those people have the freedom. And I think we think money buys us stuff, and really money is freedom. And it's the freedom to attend our kids' events, or it's the freedom, you know, as a business owner to be flexible in your hours, not to work less, but to be flexible. So if you didn't ask, and there's a lot of sporting coaches, you know, throughout the country, just like you, that aren't asking those questions to parents. So that's good advice. And then I think the other thing is, you know, you did what a lot of people kind of think about, but they don't do, is go find resources. I mean, the world's chock full of people that want to help you be successful. And it's not the 2 a.m. infomercial or the people that are sponsoring ads on your social media. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but those, you know, those are people that tell you it's super easy. But the local people at the investment groups and clubs that are like, hey, it's hard, but it's worth it. And it sounds like you were fortunate to kind of be in the right place and meet the right type of people.
Yeah, definitely. And I think utilizing LinkedIn and being able to connect with people who weren't necessarily in my area was also super helpful. Like I said, my first mentor actually lived in Long Island. So we were probably as far apart as we could get. And it worked out really well.
Wonderful. Well, you know, it's such a great journey to see, because it's not an easy one, and you've had to kind of build your way. And now you've got really two areas of your life where you're making money, which is you run a business where you help people, right? While helping yourself, right? As a business. And then you also have this personal side where you can build your portfolio. And those two things aren't mutually exclusive, right? And just like back when you were earning commissions, you know, in your day job, you were taking that money and building that passive income. And so it's such a powerful strategy. And I think people are starting to get the gist of it, you know, that it is important and passive investing is critical, but, you know, more and more people need to take that approach. Let's talk a little bit about 7E, if we can for a minute. You know, you guys, as a business, really help everybody, right? So my understanding is that you're a Reg A, and for those that don't know, there's some different SEC filings as it relates to how or who you can raise money from. So Reg A is really, I would say, probably the most open, right? Allows accredited or non-accredited investors. Yeah. Am I directionally right there?
Yes, you are. I kind of like to say, I draw analogies to everything. It's kind of like crowdfunding in for real estate. So anyone can invest. We can market to anyone. You don't have to be accredited, and typically there's a lower minimum.
Awesome. And really the goal for you guys as a business, right, is to produce returns so that you can ensure your investors get paid. And then if there's money left over, ensure that the business generates a profit.
Correct. Yeah. And the way it's set up for us, investors come first. And really the goal was to provide something that was, and Chris and I talk about this a lot, accessible and available. So you don't see many offerings that, you know, are accessible and that you have to be accredited to do them, and then available and that you have to be accredited to do them, and then accessible, and that the minimum for most offerings is like 50, 100K. For us, it was really important as investors who kind of went through this ourselves. That's a lot to invest in your first investment, especially if you don't really know what you're doing and it might be your first kind of rodeo. So it was really important to us to go that kind of route of making it both available and accessible to like the masses.
Well, that minimum is so critical, because it is, you know, if you think about people's historic saving rates on average, you know, my guess, and I'm going to be directionally close, is people don't really accumulate over $50,000 of investable savings until they're probably in their 40s or 50s. And so that's a little late in the game. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but if you can start investing in your 20s and 30s, now you can really start getting the value of that compound interest. And that's where that payoff over the long period of time starts to take shape. So let's talk about the secondary market for loans, right? You know, there's so many different ways to talk about loans, and loans in very simple form are somebody borrows money with a promise to pay back under certain terms and certain collateral where applicable, right? Pretty simple. Yep. But the secondary market is really after the loan's been created. So I go to Bank of America, I borrow $200,000 to buy a house. 10 years later, this loan still exists because it's a 30-year loan. And now, you know, Lauren and her team are looking at buying that loan on the secondary market. Talk to us a little bit about that. Like, what the heck is this secondary market? How do people access it? How do you find these things? And then we'll talk a little bit about kind of what you do and the methodology on this fix and flip side.
Yeah. So if anyone listening has ever owned a home and you've taken out a mortgage, and maybe even something as little as 6 months later, you get a letter in the mail saying, hey, JP Morgan has sold your, you know, loan to Bank of America, and now send all your payments to Bank of America. I remember when we purchased our first primary residence thinking, oh my gosh, what happened? This is bad. This is really bad, because this is prior to me getting into mortgage notes. And so that's essentially the secondary market, is your loan is being bought and sold. And most loans are sold multiple times throughout their term. And there's multiple reasons a bank or credit unions or other funds would sell loans. And those could be, for example, right now in this economic climate, banks are looking to be liquid. No one wants what happened to Silicon Valley Bank to happen to them. So they're looking at these loans that were written at 3%, and they're thinking, oh my gosh, I'm losing money on these loans right now. They can sell them. You package them up, sell them at a discount, and then go and rewrite new debt at 6-7% plus, and, you know, kind of rebalance their books. So they're trying to get bad, which might not even be a defaulted loan. It just could be a loan that's not making them money, off their books. So that's kind of why banks would sell. And, you know, banks sell for those variety of reasons. But then you also have people on the secondary market who are looking to buy non-performing loans. And so people are thinking, well, yeah, why won't the bank just go ahead and go through foreclosure on their own? And this industry, this asset class, I feel like a lot of it is like breaking stereotypes and misconceptions people have. And banks are super, super good at creating debt. We all know this. Look at any bank. They're really good at it. That is their strength. Managing debt is a very different skill set that banks are really not staffed or equipped for. And it requires a lot of one upfront capital and time, neither of which banks have the patience for, because again, if they can sell these loans that are in default at a discount, they don't care because it might have taken them 2-3 years to go through a foreclosure process instead of selling it at a discount and rewriting something at, again, 6%+ with where we are at today. So there's a couple of reasons banks sell. And then from a buyer's perspective, the secondary market is kind of like this underground. You know, I think it used to be a lot easier to get into as an individual investor who wanted to buy like a one-off note. COVID kind of changed the dynamic in the landscape a little bit in that you used to be able to self-service your loans. Now, there is no way you are self-servicing a loan. There is the CFPB, which stands for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, kind of sounds like a Marvel arm, but they essentially put down all these rules and regulations and made it significantly harder for the individual to get involved and scale their business in notes because of all the rules and then the money that goes into making sure those regulations are followed. So the secondary market of investors looking to buy into mortgage notes, we see a lot of self-directed IRA investors, a lot of smaller funds. You have your BlackRock and Blackstone. Those are the two that pretty much take a majority of the loans. And then they kind of filter down from there. They'll say, we're going to buy a tranche of 10,000. Then we're going to take these 5,000 and sell them to these four funds. And then they kind of, it goes on. And it could be for a variety of reasons. It might be that they don't fit their certain buy box, or that they only do performing loans and not non-performing, or they only do seconds and not first. So it's really about, I mean, if you're looking to get into the secondary market as an individual investor, it's about networking. It's about finding who's selling loans and building trust and a relationship with them so that they know, one, you're going to follow the rules, because if you don't follow the rules, it can come back to them. And then two, like, you're someone who says and does what they say they're going to do. So if you bid on 5 assets and you continually are saying, oh, just kidding, you know, no one's really going to take you seriously anymore. So it's a pretty, everyone kind of knows everyone market, but that's kind of why I like it.
Well, it is, you know, and that secondary market, it is unique. You know, it's not like you just pop on a Zillow and look at the secondary market for real estate, right? That's just so common. But you're right, this world of private notes, and it's massive. And, you know, just like a home doesn't, you know, go away, right? It's technically there until someone knocks it down. Mm-hmm. A lot of these mortgage notes, I mean, they're 30-year lives. And so, you know, when people are underwriting this, they're not planning what the next 30 years looks like. I mean, heck, think about if you 10 years ago, you know, had to make a 30-year decision with what you knew at the time. I mean, you would never have seen, you know, what transpired through COVID. You would never have expected rates to drop to the lowest, you know, historically. You'd never expect them to shoot off like a rocket ship, right? And these are all things that from a bank's balance sheet standpoint, they got to account for. And so they're making decisions with today's info, but they've got to go kind of really look back at what they did 10 to 20 years ago and determine if they need to pivot. And so, you know, I think we're in for a really good ride on the secondary market for quite some time, especially in non-performing notes. You know, it obviously the market conditions always change. And as they do, the strategy behind it has to change. But, you know, there really wasn't in the last 10 years, we didn't have near the amount of non-performing loans as we did in the previous 10-year period. But now we're kind of entering in an area where we're seeing prices cool off, maybe even some prices go down, we're seeing layoffs. And so those things tend to make non-performing loan. And as a result, right, it creates more opportunity. So we're going to talk about this fix and flip model. I want to just take a quick pause. We're going to put you on the hot seat, Lauren, for our quirky questions of the day. We've got three listener submitted questions that we're going to ask you, unrelated to anything we're talking about today, just for some fun. No wrong answers. Don't worry. Thank you, Amy. Just so you know, I don't even see these until we read them out. So once we're done with these, we're going to dig into this fix and flip model on a note, because I used a couple terms that I'm dying to get to the bottom of what they mean. So you ready to get on the hot seat?
Oh gosh, I think so. I'm like, what's my favorite book?
Oh, I don't think that, you know, there, I do see the word book on here, but all right. Question number one, what's something common from your childhood that's going to be strange to future generations?
Gosh, so many things. This is a very millennial here. Well, there's probably like a host of things I could go into, but top of mind is this like incessant push that you have to go to college and get a four-year degree. I think that future generations, like I have two little boys. When my two little boys are grown and they look at that, they're going to be like, that is wild that you spent X amount of money to go to school for a degree you're not even practicing in. And I think that narrative is changing already. I know the way we talk about it towards our kids and Lil is changing. So I think the next generation is just going to be looking at history being like, that was a thing. There's so many ways to make a career and a living, but that was a thing. That was like a, you have to do this. So that's just top of mind recently.
That is a very good one. And we've got two kids as well. And it is, I think you find yourself naturally saying college, and then you realize, or whatever you do, like college really isn't, you know, it's a great institution and it's a great academic approach, but I'm with you. I think, people are learning and realizing, and, you know, I think one thing that's different, not divert too much, but one thing that's really interesting about the world we live in, and it kind of goes back, Lauren, to how you found yourself sitting in a seat, listening to someone talking about how you can become an investor. You know, the generationally, you know, our kids, right, they'll only know education at their fingertips 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And, you know, I hate to say, you know, I think I'm older than you, aging myself. You know, if I wanted information as a kid, I asked somebody that I could talk to. I picked up an actual telephone and dialed a number, right? Or I had to read an encyclopedia. You know, the internet, you know, became popular as I got into kind of like late elementary and middle school. But even then, it really didn't serve its function. You know, we didn't have a computer in my house, so I was in middle school. So I never really had that. But our kids today at 4 and 5 and 6, I mean, between YouTube and all these other things. So it's my hope for that generation is that they understand how to process information the right way and get the right bits of information, because just as dangerous as it can be, it could be so powerful. These kids are going to be smarter than we've ever been in our whole lives, if they're not already.
Oh, we could talk about this for ages. I was just thinking as you were talking about this, like, yeah, it's absolutely dangerous. I hope that one of my biggest hopes is like, can you ask the critical thinking questions and you sift through all the noise?
Yep. But, you know, the world adapts. And I think sometimes it's easy to think that because we didn't have it and look how we turned out, they have it, it's only going to poison them. There will be winners and losers for sure in any bit of technology change. But I do think it's a if used right, even for us as adults, it's used right. And when it's used wrong, it has adverse consequences. But yeah, we're in an information age. There's really no excuse to be ignorant anymore. And just 10 or 15 years ago, there was borderline an excuse to not know the answer to something. But today, just ask Siri and you'll get whatever you need. Question number two.
Yes.
This is a simple one. Okay. Books or movies?
Oh. A month ago, I would have said movies, but I've really been into a book kick lately. And now I'm like, I want to see if something's based off of, if there's a movie based off a book, I want to have read the book first. And most movies, I'm like, I feel like there's not that much original coming out anymore. I'm kind of like same storyline. There's like 10 of them. So definitely books.
Okay. Books it is. Number three, if you could turn any activity into an Olympic sport, what are you winning the gold medal in?
Any activity. Oh, God. Raising two boys. Like, I don't even know. Chasing two boys around the house. Like, keeping them out of the ER. Like, if anyone is listening and has two boys or even one boy, you know what I'm talking about. Oh, no, I have one. And this is going to seem so weird. But leaving voice, like getting people to adopt leaving voice memos. So if you have an iPhone, you can leave a voice memo, right? Like, do you know about this? Okay.
I do.
Okay. Getting people to adopt using iPhone or using voice memos instead of texting. I feel like I would crush that if it was Olympics.
So you're a voice memoer.
I am a voice memoer. Oh, I became a mom and I was like, I have no hands to text, but I can press record and it's so much easier. I'm like, why would people text? I can just, I don't even, if someone leaves me a voice message, I'm like, I'm not, or a voicemail, I'm like, I'm not listening to that. You're just telling me to call you back. Leave me a voice memo if you have something to say.
You're an early adopter. That's for sure. I'm embarrassed to say this out loud, but I'm a voice to texter.
Oh no.
Right? And it's not good. And I need to switch. I mumble when I talk, nothing ever comes out right. I have to clarify half my messages, but I do it so much that there are two major problems that I've learned. Number one, my wife makes fun of me because no matter where I'm at, when I, even in my vehicle where I'm on Bluetooth, I hold the phone directly to my mouth as if it can't hear me. You know, but the second thing is, and this is so bad, is I don't leave a lot of voicemails, but when I do, I find myself, and I've done this multiple times on a voicemail, I'll use punctuation in my voicemail. So it'll be like, hey, Lauren, this is Jason. Give me a call back, comma, want to chat. And then I'm like, oh my gosh, I just left the voicemail where I'm using words like comma, period, expecting it to voice the text. So, well, you're way ahead of me on the voice memo and I need to adopt.
Yeah, give it a shot. Then they can hear. I also feel like it's nice. You can hear tone, inflection. A lot of that drives me nuts in text messaging. I'm like, I don't know. Was that said with a sassy tone, sarcastic, happy, annoyed? Like,
yep.
What's going on here?
Well, as your boys get older, my 12-year-old is great because anytime I see an emoji that I don't know, I can always say like, happy, sad, are they yelling at me? Are they upset with me? You know, he can give me the full insight. That's another language that I've yet to quite crack the code on.
Love that.
Lauren, you are officially off the hot seat.
Oh, cool.
So thank you for those of you that continue to send in your questions. They're always fun. I always love this part of the show. It's definitely, we get some out there ones, but keep them coming. You can email those to allaboutalts@newviewtrust.com. We've all been waiting. You use two terms that I think we know, right? Fix and flip and rehab. And I think we're all familiar with the A&E or HGTV show, right? You buy something in shambles, you put paint and granite countertops and you get Chip and Joanna to, you know, give you a good color palette and you sell it and you make a bazillion dollars and, you know, everybody's happy, right? That's the fix and flip and rehab model. You use those same words, but we're talking about private loans. So let's start with fix and flip on the private loan side. Help me understand this model, right? Where you don't have paint and you don't have, you know, all these fancy granites that you can put in. What are you doing to fix and flip a loan?
Yeah. So obviously similar to a fixing and flipping a house, you're buying it at a discount because it's not in good shape. So in our case, we're buying them at a significant discount because the borrower hasn't paid anywhere in 90 plus days. So they're considered distressed. People want them off their books. We get them at a discount and then comes the fix part. And so instead of doing the paint, the granite countertops and all of that, we actually rehab the borrower. So we're not rehabbing the property, we're rehabbing the borrower and their payments. Now, I mentioned earlier that a lot of this asset class is about kind of breaking the stereotypes and educating, you know, the masses on what borrowers who come to be in our portfolio, like their actual situation. I think when I bought my first home, I thought if I don't make a payment, I'm going to lose my home in like next month. Like if I miss one payment, I am out. That's definitely not the case. Our average delinquency is about 3 years. So Like, wow. We're not talking a few months. Yeah, we're talking years. But in over 95% of our portfolio, it is not because the borrower decided to wake up one day and say, I'm not paying my mortgage. Today's the, you know, screw them. Today's the day. I'm even not even, am I allowed to say that? I don't know. You know, the 95% of them really fell on some sort of big life situation. So it's typically job loss, divorce, death, or a health issue. So those are kind of like the four buckets that I'd say 95% of our portfolio fall into. And I'll give you an example of how we will rehab. So what typically happens is a borrower falls behind. Say they, for example, we had a borrower who had a health condition come up. He actually had cancer. So his funds were going into, rightly so, trying to save his own life. Stopped paying his mortgage. He was 6 months behind. When he went back to the bank and said, hey, I can start paying my monthly P&I again. And they, at this point, he's 30,000 plus behind. And they say, that's great, but we're applying it to your late fees and past due. At that point, the guy's never going to catch up. He's literally constantly paying towards past interest accrued and late fees. So he kind of gives up. It becomes this snowball that he just can't get ahead of. It's taking off downhill. We acquire this loan and we reach out. So what we do is the first step in once we onboard the loan is we send that letter that you might've gotten in the mail saying, hey, send your payments to us now. Typically, if they're non-performing, they don't. So we start, with a demand letter. And if you're unfamiliar with that, it's really the first step in the foreclosure process. Now, for us and our kind of philosophy, our intent is not to foreclose first. So, however, getting a demand letter from an attorney is going to get them to come to the table a lot quicker than, you know, getting a letter from our servicer saying, hey, like, you haven't paid, give us a call. So by initiating that, sending that demand letter and initiating foreclosure, about 90% of our portfolio will come to the table, whether it's immediately or within a month or two. So this guy comes to the table and he says, hey, this is what happened. I can continue to make my monthly payments. We say, great. We have flexibility. Banks don't. And that's one of the biggest differences. Banks are very regulated and tied to this is the box that we can work in. And that is it. There is nothing outside the box. Whereas ours is just a big field of like, what are the opportunities that we can work with? How can we work with you? So this man, we put him on what's called a trial payment plan. He continued to make 6 consecutive payments towards, you know, his monthly. And then what we did at the end of that was if he completed that 6 months saying, you know, showing us that he could actually make those payments on time as expected, then we work with him on the arrears. Now, in his instance, he was going to make quarterly payments towards the arrears. So he continued to make his monthly payments. We weren't applying them to past due. We were applying them to current due. And the quarterly payments went towards his arrears. In other instances, we've extended the term. So we've taken that $30,000 and added a few years onto the loan to make up for it. We don't touch interest rate because it opens us up to a whole new can of worms. But there's a lot we can do without that really help us work with the borrower. Now, we do have about 5% who don't come to the table. And typically it can be because family inherited the house because the borrower died and they didn't know where the payment was supposed to go, or they don't really want the property. The property was vacant, or it's an investor property, so not owner occupied. And they're going to file for bankruptcy, throw all the things in the playbook, which is a lesson we have learned. We don't necessarily invest in non-owner occupied homes for that reason. But it's really such a small percentage like that go through foreclosure because of that. Most of our borrowers that we work with are very excited to have someone who's willing to kind of work with a new set of rules that can really work with them rather than just, you know, kind of whatever the bank says goes. And that's called rehabbing the borrower. So once they've made about 12 months consecutively of payments, you're increasing the value of the loan. So the loan value has increased because it's considered re-performing or performing. and then you sell it back on the secondary market to someone who's looking for that mailbox money or passive income, and you are selling it for a profit.
That's so much fun. You know, it really is. I think the thing that I love about it, you know, nobody, the idea and stereotype of that, if people aren't making their payments, they're prepared to lose their house. Like, nobody wants to lose their house. I think there's a small percentage of people that are comfortable with that idea and maybe even try to game the system to live there for free as long as they can. We certainly saw that during the Great Recession. But at the end of the day, I mean, people made an emotional decision, their largest financial commitment to buy that house. They're usually not just sitting on cash saying, you know, sticking their nose up to the bank. I mean, there's a life event. So, you know, to me, it kind of goes back to this idea that, you know, as investors, right, whether it be real estate or in this case, rehabbing notes, like, we should be helping people understand we're not driving returns. Like, yes, we want to make money, but think about the value that house doesn't turn over. That person now makes mortgage payments. They're probably more likely to go out and mow the grass and have the house pressure washed because they have more pride of ownership. Or, you know, all of these things are helping people. They're helping neighborhoods. They're helping the community. And they're doing that, I don't want to say, well, helping ourselves as if that's a bad thing. It's a good thing that we can accomplish all that. So I can imagine in that seat for you, because you're actually having these discussions, hearing these life events, and I'd imagine very, very few times do you ever finish that conversation and go, yeah, that person's a jerk. They really, you know, aren't going to work with us. You're probably like, gosh, this poor, you know, guy, girl, husband, wife, kids, whatever it is, like, how can we get them to the other side of success?
Yeah. And I think you make a good point. And you brought up 2008, and I'm glad you did, because we get asked about this a lot. Well, how is this different? People were walking away from their homes all the time in 2008. Yes, but it was a very different economic climate. People were underwater. There was really nothing they could. They had zero options. Now, most of the loans we have substantial equity. It's like our loan to value on our portfolio is 30%. Like, there is significant coverage for both us and the borrower. They can even go refinance. The reason they don't is because it's probably cheaper to work with us and keep their monthly payment at what it is than go refi. Even though that would probably cover their debt, they probably just can't afford that new monthly. And so I think it's just really important to know that this is very different than 2008 in terms of, like, you know, you look around now, there's no inventory. Rent is through the roof everywhere. So the borrowers are really incentivized to want to come to the table to work with us. And you're right, I haven't heard that in a while, what you mentioned about, you know, they're more incentivized to mow their lawn, which helps increase the value of their house, then increases the value of the neighborhood and the schools and all of that. It really does have a cascading effect. And it's funny because we used to talk about this more, and I haven't heard someone bring that up in a while. So I'm glad you did. I forget about it sometimes.
Well, you know, I think sometimes as investors, we're scared, you know, to talk about, like, you know, we go in and we clean up houses, or, you know, people think, you know, and there's just such a negative stigma in the news that it's investors driving up all these prices. And, you know, I think there's just a big gap between, you know, and I won't say we're mom and pop investors. That may be a little bit of a poor term, but we are. We're not BlackRock. We're not buying every single thing inside and renting them and saying, I don't really care if this is a business. It's still a people business. We deal with people. We negotiate with people. We support people. We help people. And that's something that I don't think, hopefully, will never go away. But the economic climate today is significantly different. You know, I know some folks in the banking industry, and, you know, when you ask them, they're saying the same thing. Like, our portfolio, while sure, I mean, if the market slides 10 or 20%, yeah, I mean, we're gonna have to, you know, figure it out. It's, nobody wants to deal with that. Mm-hmm. But in 2007, you know, so many people were on the brink of bankruptcy the day they bought their house. Whereas today, very few people are buying house without money down. There, very few people are buying house without some equity. And so hopefully the narrative will be different. And while we're not cheering for non-performing notes, you know, they're going to continue to happen. And if we can keep these loans from, you know, foreclosure, which nobody wins except for the attorneys, you know, that are on each side of that, if we can help these people stay in their homes, and we can do that while getting it off the bank's balance sheet because they don't want it, and finding a good solution, that's a very rewarding place to be. Let's talk a little bit about, you mentioned kind of the portfolio and, you know, you've got these loans in there. What is, you know, the overall investment philosophy of maybe just 70 as a whole? You know, is there types of loans? I know we talked about non-performing loans and your goal is to get them to performing, but, you know, is there a buy box that you guys are in? Is it certain periods of time? Is it certain geographic areas? Is it certain demographics of property types or borrowers or anything along those lines?
Yeah. So single family homes, first position, performing, meaning they're paying on time as expected per the terms of their mortgage agreement. About 40% of our portfolio, a little bit more at this point. And then non-performing as well. So kind of a mix of both. Low crime areas were populated areas. So we're not buying something in the middle of nowhere. As far as like specific states, we are pretty, we're all over, but we don't love like New York, New Jersey for obvious reasons. Really, a borrower has zero incentive at all to work with you. So Midwest, Southeast, those are probably where we have the most amount of loans. Northeast, I'm trying to think if there's anything specific. LTV, obviously, I mean, validating values on the assets that these loans are secured by is probably the number one thing we look at. And then legally, is title clean? Is this actually a first lien and not a third lien? So a lot of our due diligence, it's kind of similar to buying a home. We'll put a bid out and the seller will say yes, no, or they'll counter. Once we kind of come to set price, then we do due diligence. And that's where we kind of look at everything. Like we look at servicing notes. Why did this loan default? Is this borrower going to be someone who would most likely come to the table? Really trying to mitigate that risk by looking at all aspects. We talk about looking at the property, the person, and the predicament that got them to where they were. And a big part of that is relying a lot on our external vendors that we've built up over the years. So our attorneys, our servicers, our brokers, and realtors in specific locations. And then loan value wise, we're not looking at anything over, under 100. So 100K loan or an up to about 1.5. I'd say we're looking for, if you're to imagine kind of like your bread and butter starter home, that's what we're looking. We're not looking super high end. We're also not looking for like the worst of the worst. So, and that obviously varies very much depending on what portion of the country you're looking at.
Absolutely. I couldn't help but think when you were saying 1.5 million and kind of that starter home, I thought, well, geographically, that's not in Florida. 1.5 million. Is certainly getting you a bit more than a starter home here, but I get the sentiment. And you know what I love talking about strategy, and I think you know the for our listeners today, you know, whether you're looking to invest passively or you want to become the next Lauren or the next 70, and you want to build your own investment portfolio, all of those things are great. And everybody, and we talk about this a lot on the show, you know, get off your couch, get off your phone and go do it, right? Or get on your couch and get on your phone for the right reasons and go do it. But as you're out there, that buy box is critical. And I'd imagine, you know, some of the things inside that buy box originated because you went outside of that and you learned some lessons the hard way.
Yeah. Well, like I'd mentioned it earlier, owner occupied is something we look at. And it is a risk factor that we have to take into account, no matter how good the LTV or asset looks. We've just know that those don't typically go so well. So for that reason, borrower, owner occupied is really important to us.
Well, and that's the beauty of investing. You know, you stubbed your toe probably on a few of those deals, and that's okay. If anyone tells you that their portfolio is filled with winners, they're a real liar, because you have to have some losses, and the losses don't have to be material, but they have to be losses of time, losses of energy, losses of funds or money. It just simply happens. So I have loved this. I love the rehab the borrower. I love the fix and flip on the note side. I think that's a really fun way to describe it. As we wrap things up, first of all, thank you for being a wealth of knowledge and really schooling us and our listeners on this kind of fun way to get into the real estate world, but not be a real estate owner, right? That's a pretty cool takeaway. But the second thing is that, you know, you started with no knowledge, you didn't come from a real estate lending background where you were underwriting deals and you felt like, let me just do that for myself. You really had to kind of go outside the box, get the information, and you've been able to not just build a business, but to also build a really nice personal portfolio. So congratulations to you on all of your success.
Thanks. Yeah. Something you said earlier, you were talking about, you know, we think money gives us more money or, you know, but you said it buys freedom or gives us freedom. And I think when talking to people who want to get passive income, or, you know, that's kind of the buzzword. And I think it has been for probably a few decades, is passive income. I think there's this misconception that, like, oh, if you get passive income, you, like, the goal is to retire. I mean, my goal is to make it work optional for you or for people. Or, you know, for example, I have a few friends, former colleagues, who now they're working at startups because they want to work at those startups. They don't have to worry about that 150, 200K salary. They're like, we have that taken care of. We can now invest and, like, put our passion into something we can truly get behind. And for them, that's like early stage startups, but it could be for you. For me, it's the business side of it. You know, I am super passionate about what we do at 7E for behind the educating and accessibility for investors. So I think it's more, when you look at passive income, don't look at it as like, oh, it allows me to, like, you know, not do anything anymore. It allows you to do what you want when you want versus nothing.
Absolutely. That's such a great, I think, bow to put on an already great episode. And that is, there is, you know, money means different things to different people, but I think you nailed it. Like, work because you want to, not because you have to. And it's really cool that people can do things that they're very passionate about. And it stinks. There's a lot of people that are passionate about a lot of things, but they'll never give themselves the opportunity to experience that or dive into it because they've got these kind of golden shackles, you know, to their weekly or monthly income. So a lot going on in today's episode, an absolute rock star of a guest. Lauren, thank you so much. Before we let you go, we're going to wrap up with our season two last question that everybody gets. And that is, what's keeping you up at night right now, aside from the two boys?
I was going to say my youngest, who doesn't sleep. He's like a never napper. What's keeping me up at night? I just worry, this is such a parent thing to say, a mom thing to say. Honestly, what keeps me up at night is worrying about all of the information thrown at our kids and the future generation, which we touched upon. So it's, yeah, that keeps me up at night, you know, and just all the stuff, all the information, the data, all of it. And you have older kids than I do. So, you know, my kids are 6 and 3, and I'm already kind of worried about that. Now I can imagine it doesn't get easier as you get that peer pressure of, like, everyone has a phone and I don't. But yeah, it definitely, not much keeps me up at night. That, and not really anything in the business, to be honest. I mean, so it's really just that, how the next generation, how do we get them to think critically and have conversations and be open to discussing ideas that aren't theirs? I think that kind of, like, how do they do better than we are doing?
Well, that one certainly keeps me, and I'd imagine a lot of people, up as well. It's the million-dollar question. You know, I think my hope for you know, future generations is that they do figure it out. And I think the markets force you to figure it out. You know, life kind of forces you to figure out. But I think we all see some signs that we just go, gosh, that's scary, and that's powerful, which is good and bad. But I guess time will tell, and we'll all keep doing our job as parents, as at least turning their shoulders a little bit and in a moderate direction. Let's just hope they take it.
Yeah, I love that. Love that. Well, thanks so much for having me. Happy to be here.
It was great having you. Thanks for all the new terms and some great dialogue. I think there's a lot for our listeners to digest today. Thanks for everyone for tuning in. As always, hit the like, share, subscribe button. Leave us a 5-star review. We love continuing to build the community of investors looking to see and invest in alternatives differently as we go forward. So thanks for being here. We'll see you guys next week. Thanks again, Lauren.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening. We hope the information within this podcast has given you the tools that you need to find your way to financial independence. We would love to partner with you on this journey. Text ALTS, that's ALTS, to 407-708-1853 to learn more about how to get started today. Don't forget to follow us to make sure you don't miss a second of content, and we'll see you next week.